This week, in response to a whole lot of different things in the news, I called up my high school history teacher, Mrs. Clark.
So I'm Mrs. Clark still, Laura. Will I be Mrs. Clark forever? It's okay.
I hadn't talked to Mrs. Clark for 20 years, but she remembered me, and I sure remembered her. One of the things I remember so much that you used to do is you used to tell history like a big, dramatic, giant story. You know, that we all got to sort of be on the sidelines of watching. And is that something you did on purpose?
Oh, yes, I think I did. And it's very gratifying to hear you say that. I think a lot of being a history teacher is being really in love with the subject matter.
I call Mrs. Clark, of course, because of the news this week that lesser American history teachers may have something to answer for. Most of their students, a federal study reported, do not know basic historical facts like why Abraham Lincoln is important or what problem Brown versus Board of Education solved. We'll have more from Mrs. Clark in a moment, but first, a line here from an article in the New York Times. It reads, 25% of students do not know that Abraham Lincoln was president during the Civil War. Care to take a guess when that article was published? Here's a hint. It wasn't last week.
Well, it could probably be in 1943.
Diane Ravitch is a historian of education, and she's right. That 1943 article was headlined, Ignorance of U.S. History Shown by College Freshmen. Every 10 years or so, you can find almost that exact same article printed again, like clockwork.
There is currently a narrative in this country of failure and decline. The fact is the schools are not in decline. We have seen fairly dramatic improvement in the reading and math skills of our children since the early 70s.
There are also tests that come out every few years that stack American education up against that of other countries. You say the first test of this kind was issued in the mid-1960s.
Right.
How did we do that?
We came in last. This is ironic, as part of the decline narrative is saying, look at these international test scores. The last one came out this past December. We placed in about the middle. We didn't do that well, but the response was gloom and doom.
And yet it was an improvement.
Well, what they didn't seem to realize was we've never been first in the world in math and science. In the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, we have been in the bottom quartile. So when you hear this declinist rhetoric, we have the biggest economy in the world, the most successful economy in the world, the most productive workers, the most inventors. How could all of this success have come from kids who were in the bottom quartile in the international assessments? It suggests to me that there's no connection.
Education historian Diane Ravitch. So back to my history teacher, Mrs. Clark. It turns out in a few years there will be a national assessment test that may be a bit easier on students than this past week's history test. The same federal testing program is going to test them on techno-literacy, how much they know about computers and technology.
Well, it's actually a brand new assessment.
Steve Schneider is a senior program director at WestEd, the company developing the framework for the new test.
They've had a national assessment for educational progress in art. They've had it in music. They've had it in English language arts. They've had it in mathematics. They've had it in history. And everyone said, what about technological literacy and engineering, since we're into the 21st century and there's a large global demand for our students to be able to compete in these areas?
So we asked Steve Schneider to draw up some sample questions to figure out how a history teacher might do on this new techno-literacy quiz. Mrs. Clark and I took on the challenge.
Trace the evolution of features on an early cell phone compared to current smartphone technologies.
All right, so you're saying how is the early cell phone different than the new cell phone? Mrs. Clark, do you have a cell phone?
Well, believe it or not, I've only had a cell phone for the last like a year and a half.
So okay.
But they were just about phone calls in the past. And now they've got full-on computers in them.
And I also sort of remember that you could talk for about 3 minutes and then it would go dead.
Yes.
Is any of that?
Me true.
What do you think? Are we close?
You guys are on the right track. Would you like the next question?
Yes, we're ready.
Okay, describe a set of troubleshooting steps that would be appropriate for analyzing a problem with a printer.
Nah. Call in the tech guy.
Yeah, that was my number two. A big thanks to Mrs. Clark and Steve Schneider. You can find more sample questions from the new techno-literacy test on our website at npr.org. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
The NBA season ended this week with a Texas-sized celebration for the new champions. Chants of MVP greeted Dallas Mavericks star Dirk Nowitzki as he and his teammates rode through the streets of Dallas on Thursday. The excitement at that victory parade may soon disappear, though. The NBA is poised to follow the lead of the National Football League and shut down business with a lockout of players. It could happen in less than 2 weeks when the current NBA labor contract expires. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
At the Dallas parade, Brian Griffin spoke for many, many NBA fans.
I don't want to just have to watch baseball all year and hockey. That's going to be terrible. I'm extremely worried about the lockout.
A labor war and work stoppage may be unavoidable considering how owners and players disagree on some pretty basic issues surrounding a new contract. The league is worried about its crummy financial situation. It says more than half its teams are losing money, more than $300 million a year. Here's NBA Deputy Commissioner Adam Silver at the recent finals speaking on a sound system that seems to support the league's claim of poverty.
Costs have risen much faster than revenues over the course of this deal.
This deal, the labor contract that's been in place since 2005, needs an overhaul, says Silver and his boss, NBA Commissioner David Stern. The new contract, this is still the league talking, should be set up so the money teams have been losing can be reclaimed by cutting player salaries. $800 million a year is the target mentioned publicly. Privately, the league says it can be less. How to achieve those cuts? There are several proposals, but only one, a hard cap on player salaries, meaning this is how much you can spend and you can't go over. Only the hard cap prompts the following sound effect. Screeching tires, as in, hold on there. This is the union talking now. Actually, this is.
The association is very much against any kind of a hard cap.
Larry Katz is one of the lawyers representing the Players Association in contract talks. The NBA has enjoyed a soft salary cap, meaning teams can exceed it in certain circumstances without penalty. Not only does the union not want the soft cap messed with, the players, not surprisingly, have a beef with the league wanting to balance its books by cutting player payroll. Larry Katz.
The players believe that when the owners of particular teams are losing money, that's due to bad management or aggressive bidding for player contracts. To give back large sums of money to make up for those kind of management decisions is the wrong decision.
NBA writer Henry Abbott, he writes the True Hoop blog for ESPN.com, has hacked his way through the he said of NBA labor for the better part of a year. There's concern a hard salary cap will change the way the league looks by forcing teams to jettison players. Abbott doesn't think that'll happen.
The players just are so adamant on that point. So I think we'll end up with a world where teams can have some wiggle room to keep their best players together.
Also, while owners claim revenues have been outpaced by costs, Abbott says league revenues that pay for player salaries have gone up.
Which is an amazing endorsement of the league and its players and the popularity of the product.
Everybody has a lot to gain, says Abbott, from the NBA being up and running next fall. There may be saber-rattling now, he says, maybe even a lockout, but no games lost. Abbott feels good about his prediction. After picking Miami to win the title, he's due. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
And now a Father's Day story about a dad half a world away and how he stays connected to his wife and baby daughter.
My name is Carrie Bielowitz. My husband, Ken, just recently deployed to Afghanistan. When he deployed, we had a six-month-old daughter, Abigail. We made the decision to have Ken read to a camera 5 storybooks for Abigail.
There was an old lady who swallowed a trout that splished and splashed and thrashed about.
So every night, we open up the computer, we hit play, and we watch Daddy read a book.
There was an old lady who swallowed a seal. She let out a squeal when she swallowed the seal.
Daddy? Dada? Ken and I have been married for 2 years now, so this is the first time that he's been deployed since we've been married as new parents. It's a whole new experience. So I try to find all the literature possible of best ways to keep a marriage going and to keep him in Abby's life. A lot of the literature suggested that he read books just to hear his voice.
Duck loves to dance. but she isn't very good.
One of Abby's favorite books is Dancing Duck. I think she likes it just because of the way Ken reads it. It's a book that you pull out the last word, so she gets very excited about the tab that's going to be pulled out.
Bunny loves to hide, but she also likes being fat.
Probably after this whole year deployment, I will not like these books anymore, though. Another book that he reads probably isn't her favorite, but it's one of mine because it's very sentimental. It's Wherever You Go, My Love Will Find You. And I think Ken, probably when he was reading this, got pretty sentimental as well. He starts it off by saying,
Abigail, wherever you are, my love will find you. I wanted you more than you will ever know. So I sent love to follow wherever you go.
The first couple weeks were hard. Hearing him and seeing him read to her. Just because I was still emotional from him leaving. And obviously I am still emotional about him being gone. Yeah, the first couple weeks I pretty much cried every time that he read to her. Especially when she would point to him and saying da, 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 da.
So someday if you're lonely or someday you're sad, or you strike out at baseball, or think you've been bad. Just lift up your face, feel the wind in your hair. That's me, my sweet baby. My love is right there.
Who is this? Papa? She definitely recognizes his voice and even tries to hug the computer once in a while. I think it will be helpful for her when he does come back. That way he's not quite the stranger. So I think she'll be affectionate towards him and we can start our life as a family again together.
You are my angel, my darling, my star. My love will find you wherever you are. You are loved. I love you, Abigail.
I guess we'd like just to say happy Father's Day to Ken. You're a great father from a million miles away. We love you.
Carrie Bielewitz and Abby will be reunited with Ken in February.
Now to the economic picture back at home. Last fall, with the U.S. economy growing at a tepid pace, the Federal Reserve made an unprecedented move. It began buying up long-term government bonds from investors as a way of pouring money into the economy. Many economists say the program probably helped stimulate growth, at least a little. Now it's supposed to expire, and Fed officials say it won't be coming back. NPR's Jim Giroli has more.
Fed officials never used the term themselves, but a lot of people have taken to calling the Fed stimulus program quantitative easing.
The purpose is to perk up the economy, which it did at least for a while.
Sun Won Son is an economist at California State University. He says the first round of quantitative easing took place in 2008 when the Fed bought up mortgage-backed securities and other assets. In the second round last fall, commonly known as QE2, the Fed bought up $600 billion worth of long-term treasury bonds. It's a huge amount of money.
When you flood the economy with money, reducing the long-term interest rates like mortgage rates, housing and mortgage markets are obviously helped. Also, with more liquidity in the economy, the value of the dollar declined, and that promoted our exports.
Not everyone agrees that QE2 has had its desired impact. The economy grew in the months after the program was started, but that could have been due to other factors. Economist Lewis Crandall of Wrights and ICAP concedes that by flooding the markets with money, the Fed probably lowered mortgage rates a bit. But, he says,
the cost of this is that we've set a really ghastly precedent.
Crandall points out that by buying treasury bonds, the Fed is essentially lending the government money. That's not a big problem now because interest rates are low and there are plenty of people who want to buy U.S. government debt. But he worries that if conditions tighten, the Fed may come under pressure to buy more debt as a way of helping the government solve its budget problems. That, he says, could lead to higher inflation. As of now, QE2 is set to expire at the end of the month. In a speech in Atlanta this month, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke noted that the economy faces a number of headwinds, like higher oil prices.
In this context, monetary policy cannot be a panacea.
To economist David Malpass, president of the consulting firm Ensema Global, Bernanke's words were a clear signal that the Fed is done trying extraordinary measures like QE2, at least for a while.
He's just saying, look, let's be realistic. The Federal Reserve can't cause growth, can't cause employment. And so there's going to have to be other tools, hard work within the economy. And I think he really meant better policy out of Washington in other areas.
Even if Bernanke wanted to extend QE2, he probably couldn't right now, says Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Baker says QE2 was highly controversial with some other Fed officials, and they probably wouldn't vote to extend it.
It's a political issue, I think, not literally a lack of tools. It's simply that given the makeup of the Open Market Committee, he lacks the majority needed to really push any further.
Baker says that's a shame because he believes QE2 could help the economy at a time when it badly needs it. Baker believes the program helped lower long-term interest rates by 2 to 3/10 of a percentage point. That means lower mortgage rates, which means more people can refinance. And he says that ultimately helps the economy grow.
But let's say it's something, if we could raise GDP growth by 0.25 percentage point, that's not huge, but that's still talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs. It seems to me, why not do that?
With the program ending, Baker says some of those gains could be gradually reversed. But some Fed officials believe the benefits of QE2 have been less than clear, and at any rate, they're far outweighed by the risks. So an attempt by the Fed to stimulate growth is ending just at a time when the economy is showing new signs of weakness. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Think of the last big movie to come out of China.
From Ang Lee, the director of Sense and Sensibility. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
That movie was released over a decade ago. Chinese filmmakers haven't been able to repeat its international success since. But Ascendon Totten from member station KPCC reports the Chinese government recently hired top Hollywood talent to produce a film based on an ancient Chinese love story.
How's this for a movie pitch? The year 700 BC, Tang Dynasty China. A powerful emperor falls in love with a beautiful commoner. They share a bond so strong, only a war could tear them apart. Sounds like perfect fodder for a Hollywood hit, right? That's what the Qujian Film and TV Investment Group is hoping. The Chinese government-owned company put down $30 million in hopes of making a movie that would celebrate Chinese culture and turn a tidy profit. It started by hiring an A-list director.
I mean, how often do you get a phone call like that that the Chinese government is interested in you making a movie?
That's Antoine Fuqua, the man behind the Oscar-winning film Training Day, right after a press conference announcing the movie. He says he didn't know what to make of the offer at first.
I was like, I'm getting set up somewhere. This is it's a setup. I'm trying to remember what I did the last time I was in China that might get me arrested.
He signed on. The company also brought on David Franzoni, the writer behind the mega hit Gladiator.
What China has right now is money.
Stan Rosen is a professor of Chinese film at the University of Southern California. He says what China doesn't have is the infrastructure and talent to consistently make international box office hits. Hollywood does. So the government is learning everything it can from the U.S. film biz. But Rosen says there's another reason China is so intent on making movies.
They're trying to get films made that present a somewhat different image of China than the one that you read about sometimes in the paper about buying resources in Latin America, Africa, all over the world, jailing Nobel Prize winners, that kind of thing.
He says it's a subtle form of propaganda. And since the Chinese government bans movies that paint it in a bad light, Rosen says even Hollywood has started making China-friendly films.
You know, 2012 is the best example, I think, because it did so well. And it was so obvious in that film that only China can save the world.
In the disaster flick 2012, starring John Cusack, the Earth is about to be soaked in a giant flood. The super rich pay to have impressively large and technologically advanced boats made in China.
Leave it to the Chinese. I didn't think it was possible. Not in the time we had.
Still, many movie makers balk at the idea of letting any government dictate their artistic vision and possibly censor content. Screenwriter David Franzoni says he plans to make the upcoming Tang Dynasty film as real and gritty as possible, even if that means depicting cruel and violent Chinese rulers.
Let's be frank, okay? I've got studios who want to censor me. This is nothing new. So whether it's a government or a studio, I'm pretty hardened to that. I'm not worried about it.
Squabbles over scripts and plots are par for the course in Hollywood. And if China wants to get into this business, that's something the government better get used to. For NPR News, I'm Sandon Totten in Los Angeles.
Economic troubles aside, Americans are finally getting some relief from high gas prices. In fact, this past week marked the fifth consecutive week of falling prices in the United States.
The biggest reason was that prices were too high in the first place. I mean, the $4 and $5 and $6 talk was really hyperbole.
That's Tom Closa, chief oil analyst with the Oil Price Information Service. The national average for a gallon of regular fuel is now $3.65. That's around 25 cents less than a month ago.
The $4 numbers are really disappearing. I really suspect that most of the country is going to see $3.25 to $3.75 during the summer.
But there is a scenario which could lead to even lower prices at the pump.
If sovereign debt worries turn into a worldwide contagion and you see a recession in Europe or in the United States, then prices could drop. But that's not something you want to root for.
Many analysts warn that gas prices could spike since global demand for crude oil, a key component in gasoline, is high. And there's always a chance for supply disruptions, particularly with unrest in the Middle East and our coming hurricane season. Tom Closa says it all amounts to discernible shifts in consumer behavior.
In April and May, people drove less. In June so far, people are driving about as much as they did last year. My suspicion is that when they get 401k reports for the second quarter in July, that they may drive a little bit less. Because I do think that regardless of the drops that we see, we're still going to be paying probably 75 cents on average more than we paid last year.
And for anyone thinking about planning a trip this summer or purchasing a new car, Closa says we've hit a baseline price for a gallon of gas.
I don't think that anyone should think about paying less than $3 for any sort of sustained period of time.
Tom Closa, chief oil analyst with the Oil Price Information Service. You're listening to NPR News.